Sri, thanks for joining me. I want to say something. You talk a lot.
I do. You've caught me in my weakest moment where somebody tells me I talk a lot. I've been told that since I was a little kid, getting caught out in multiple schools on multiple continents, talking too much.
But I love it because I mean it in the best sense. You talk to students as a professor, you've done like 5 TEDx talks. And before our current COVID time, you spoke around the world. I know that. And now you're speaking constantly. I mean, you do live streams sometimes 3 times a day. And I really don't know how you keep up with it.
I will say that all of this has gotten me in trouble at my home. I've been kicked out of my own apartment by my wife and 17-year-old twins who said, you're doing 17 hours of live streaming a week, plus every Zoom call and all the conferences. And we have a whole production business. And so all day, all night, I'm talking very loudly. And so they got so mad. Without my permission, without checking with me, they called a neighbor who had left town and said, please let him use your apartment or we will kill him. And then we'll need to use your apartment for the wake. So you have a choice. What do you want? And they said, okay, you can use it for the everyday use.
But it's the reality. Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and this is episode 9 of Insider Interviews. In this conversation, I'm talking with Sri Srinivasan, who's a leading social and digital media consultant and trainer, about why he talks so much, in a good way. Sri has been the chief digital officer of New York City, of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He's been on faculty at Columbia University School of Journalism, and now he's the inaugural Marshall Loeb Visiting Professor of Digital Innovation at Stony Brook University. So he has a lot to say, and it's really important to him that what we talk about communicates factual accuracy and positivity. So here's Sri. I love hearing your story, and we're going to talk more about that because you, for your career, really have been advising people to be good at telling their story. What are you most known for, and what do you want to be known for, Sri? Good?
Thank you. When you're doing a lot of stuff, you don't pay attention enough to your own story. And I'm sometimes like a doctor who smokes. You ever had one of those who says, don't smoke as they're inhaling and blowing smoke on your face, you know? So I'm sometimes like that. My own personal story is all built around being the outsider. I was born in Tokyo, Japan, where my father had no problem picking me out in the window. He said, the brown one is mine. Now, people on the radio and podcast can't tell, but from my name, if they hear the whole name, Srinath Srinivasan, they can probably guess it's Asian and specifically South Asian. And that started a series of adventures where I was always the outsider, and outside in race, outside in nationality, outside in gender, outside in age, outside in comfort level, outside in topic or expertise level. All of that has brought me now, I turned 50 this year, by the way. One of the things they tell you is that God laughs at all your plans. And I'm a last minute planner. But for some reason, my wife and I planned my 50th birthday in October, starting last year. This is the lesson, never plan in advance, because who knows where we'll be in October with the second wave, third wave, right, whatever else will happen. But anyway, all of that is just to say that my story has been being this outsider. And when you're an outsider at any age, at any stage in your life, you want to get people to talk instead of you talking. Because when you talk, it starts with your accent is different. Your name is different. How you look is different. So instead of you talking, you get other people to talk. And you goad them, cajole them, prompt them into speaking instead of you. And this being an outsider has led to some wonderful adventures and opportunities for me. And I'm very grateful. But it has also led to some hilarity. I don't know if you ever heard of this series of books called Encyclopedia Brown. It's about a teenage detective. He's like an encyclopedia in his knowledge. And what happens is I arrived in America from India and the Soviet Union, basically in 1980. Wow. And the teacher says to the school, we're going to teach you what encyclopedias are. This is fourth grade. I'm 9 years old. I've just arrived off the boat or Air India flight. And she says, has anyone here read the Encyclopedia Britannica? And I said, I raised my hand. I was just this earnest immigrant kid. And I raised my hand and I said, I've not read Encyclopedia Britannica, but I read Encyclopedia Brown. And it was just my earnestness to fit in. And then everybody laughed and just, I remember that moment. And what that teaches you is that you've got to first know what the hell you're talking about. Two, you have to really listen before you jump in. And that's a lesson that lasted a lifetime. And another quick story from those first days in America, I was in class and I was doodling as you do in class. And coming from Hindu culture, not exposed to American Judaism and the legacy and horrors of the Holocaust, I was just doodling. I was doodling many different things, and I doodled a swastika, which, as you know, in Hindu culture is very sacred and very holy and has nothing to do with Hitler or anything. This little Jewish kid sitting next to me glances down and freaks the heck out. Like, what the hell? You can imagine that scene, right? Like, this is just something that I had never been really experienced. We knew a little bit about Hitler and we knew a little bit about World War II. But nothing that being an American teaches you. And those are, you know, not to say that everything in my life was a series of comedic horror stories, but that was part of my upbringing. And it certainly shaped me. And that's why I like getting other people to talk, even though now I also, as you pointed out, I do talk a lot myself.
I love it. You know, I love those stories also. I had hosted a podcast called Advancing Diversity, which speaks about the need for greater diversity and inclusion, especially in the media, marketing, and advertising industry, which of course our audience is mostly comprised of. It's a real challenge in our space, and ageism, welcome to the 50s, is also part of that. I know that you were interviewed in an article about how to get hired once you're in your 50s. So it's all part and parcel of who we are and why I love podcasting, because it's hearing those stories. I had actually seen you speak about 5 years ago at a TEDx Broadway that our friends at Situation Interactive had put on, and you opened up your talk about attention as the new currency by quoting the late New York Times columnist David Carr. I'm going to use your words of using his words here. You cited him saying that the most important social media is the conversation you have with the person sitting next to you. So conversations and talking is your through line, which is a blessing for us all. So I want to hear about the conversations that you've been creating for the last several years and what you've added to your plate now with your COVID-19 show, and tell us all about the streaming shows and conversations you're conducting virtually.
Thank you. We're talking on the 76th day of my show where we're talking about COVID-19 and different aspects of it. 75 straight days because we've been locked down for 75 days. I started by saying I would do this until the lockdown ended or I got COVID-19 myself. And here we are 76 days later. And what I have, the reason I was doing this is that I have learned that during crises, starting with 9/11, that was the first time it became clear to me, is that there are great sets of people in the world who go towards crisis, right? Who go towards ground zero. Those are the first responders, the doctors, the nurses, and the journalists. And they go where everyone else is running in the other direction. And I, being at that point a college professor at Columbia Journalism School, with a wife who would never let me do that, and I don't have the instinct to run into fires anyway, I decided that one of the things you can do is, in a time of crisis, be a curator of accurate information. Even back then, we think that things are bad now with all this stuff, with disinformation, misinformation. It really started with 9/11, with the hoaxes around that. And they have lasted all of these years, including, as you know, the lie by candidate Trump about celebrations by Muslim Americans in New Jersey and things like that. There were all kinds of horrible stories, as you know. Anyway, so From that time, I've seen the value whenever there's a kind of international, national crisis where I can help in any minor way by being a curator of information, I've tried to jump in and try to use the tools of the day. So back then in 2001, it was email and a little bit of texting and a website, of course. Then 2005 was Katrina. We used blogging technology, which was new then, and a little bit of social, just the slightest bit of social. And then you come to the Mumbai attacks of 2008, where we were live on the air for 72 straight hours, almost with breaks in between, covering the terrible terrorist attack in Mumbai that was unfolding in front of the world. And we interviewed people on a tool called Blog Talk Radio, which was live radio using the web. And it changed my life and changed my understanding of what we can do. And we had, in those 72 hours, something like 35 different guests on the air, including people who were coming from CNN studios in their limos calling us. And experts from around the world joined us as experts to talk on the show that, you know, didn't exist till a few hours earlier. And that tells you that you can build a brand and build a product on the fly in real time. Things that would have taken months or years or decades to build, today you can do in days and hours if you have the right tools and the luck to go with it. And always, I'll say also not expecting anything. And we can get to that if needed. But just to finish up the story, one of my guests was on that show was the chef at Tabla, one of the great New York restaurants. Floyd Cardoz is a Danny Meyer restaurant. It was the top Indian Indo-fusion restaurant in America. And Floyd had trained at the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai at the famous restaurants there. And people were all hunkered down. His former colleagues were hunkered down while the terrorists were shooting and killing people all around them. And the heroic acts of those folks were captured in a movie many years later called the Hotel Mumbai. So that was all done on radio. Then you fast forward to Fukushima and what happened in Japan with the earthquake and tsunami. We covered that using Facebook and social. Anyway, all of these are the evolution of technology. So now we come to today's crisis. Obviously, it has to be social, has to be video more than audio alone. It has to be a global conversation, and that's what we're doing. And the saddest part of this is that Floyd Cardoz, that great chef who changed American dining forever by doing what he did at Tabla and several other restaurants, was one of the very first people to die in America of COVID-19. They say, as you know, that when Tom Hanks got sick, people paid attention. When the NBA stars got sick, people paid attention. But when someone you know and you love and you work with and admired for all those years, when he dies, that's when someone like me pays real attention. And that sort of sums up all the stuff we've been doing.
Well, I'm so sorry for that loss, for all of our losses. I also applaud you for entering your 76th show, which I know is about COVID misinformation coming up also. And I want to kind of thread that needle a little bit more. So the show is called the COVID-19 Show. And I might have this wrong because you do so many shows. You have the positivity show. Is that different?
Well, so yeah. So let me.
I'm going to ask you, why don't we list the three shows and when we can catch them?
Sure, thank you. Very kind. So when technology changes, I like to play around and try new things. So when Facebook Live started about 5 years ago, I started reading the New York Times out loud on Sunday mornings like a crazy person, just reading it out loud and testing out Facebook Live. And I did that for about 3 years when a friend of mine named Neil Parekh, who was watching this, decided that what I really need is a digital wingman. And what you need when you're doing live videos, as you know, is you're talking about a lot of things, but the audience is confused, right? Like even if you're showing the New York Times article, they'd like to read that article on their own. So he started annotating my Facebook Live streams. As I was talking, I said, this article is really good. He'd put the URL into Facebook. And that annotation is something that we help create and perfect as an idea for how you do live streams. Live streams are no longer just somebody speaking, but annotating it with comments, links, the right information at the right time to enhance the production is something we did about 2.5 years ago. And now, if you fast forward, every Sunday from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. Eastern time, we read the New York Times out loud, often with people from the New York Times.
Impressive people.
Yeah, our next guest is Joe Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. Last week was our guest was Corey Dean, the former science editor of the New York Times. We've been to the home of the travel editor, Amy Vershup, and read with her the New York Times. We went to the print editor's home in New Jersey and read the New York Times with him. And so it's a celebration of the Times, but it's also a celebration of good, accurate information and all of us. So we built a global community. Thousands of people watch one of our episodes because of the value of the network of the audience and the guest speakers, a guy named Rick Wilson, who is a very famous Republican strategist. We had 86,000 people watch live, which is, you know, insane. But that tells you something about how the network effect works. So that's one show every Sunday, 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. Eastern. Second show is this COVID-19 show that we do usually at 9 p.m. Eastern or middle of the day Eastern. But everything I'm talking, by the way, can be found on my YouTube archives, youtube.com/Srenet, S-R-E-E-N-E-T. They're also all live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and LinkedIn. So being on multiple channels is also useful. And out of that came a spinoff show called Coping with COVID-19 on WBAI radio here in New York and available worldwide on WBAI.org. One of the things that New Yorkers will recognize is that WBAI people think that something like MSNBC is like Fox. You know, they're very liberal, very progressive. And you've not lived till you've hosted a call-in show in New York City live on the air. And the kind of characters that call in, God bless them, they love the city. They are very passionate about things. And they can be from the extreme left or extreme right. And they come on and they tell you what's what.
Wow. So speaking of what's what, that is a big part of your goal is proper journalism and revealing the truths behind the myths and things like that. I must say that I love the read along with the New York Times. I've learned so much, but I don't know how you absorb it all. And I also want to know if you compete with your wife, who's a Rhodes Scholar.
My wife is our main breadwinner and a saint for keeping up with me all these years. We're married 20 years. But the first lack of saintness she showed is when she kicked me out of that apartment for these interviews and things like that. But she's amazing. She has 3 master's degrees, but loves being at home. And she's done an amazing job with our kids, as much as I get no credit and don't deserve any for our twins getting to 17. By the way, I also don't recommend to anyone to have your 17th birthday under lockdown in a Manhattan apartment with your parents. That's,
oh, man.
It is so sad. They also had 2 of their SATs canceled and everything. But as I keep saying, we're blessed. We have to be so grateful for what we have at this time when 100,000 people have died, when millions of people have been sick. We have to be grateful for what we have. And so Rupa, my wife's name is Rupa Unnikrishnan. She's at Rupa Online on Twitter. She's also was one of the world's great women rifle shooters. A sports rifle, target, not humans. And you have to be well-behaved when your wife is a rifle shooter. Her father was Inspector General of Police, like police chief in Tamil Nadu, which is a state in India. But you know what makes you really careful? Not your dad, father-in-law, not your wife shooting, but my mother-in-law won a state pistol shooting championship when Rupa was in her belly. That makes you really careful.
Oh, Sri, your family should really try to be more interesting. I can't imagine what your dinner time conversations are, you know, to keep the through line of storytelling going. I want to talk a little bit about some of the business aspect of things. You've produced a lot of social media events. You're known for that. And as a matter of fact, I was scheduled to speak back in March at what was going to be the social media weekend. And then you took that virtual for the first time. How did that work out?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for signing up. And we are going to do something together in a big way I know in the coming months. So thank you for agreeing to be on the panel. So one of the things that I have learned is that in this process of the 75 days of lockdown is that we are in a new world where lots of things are changing and lots of opportunities are also there. So when we took our physical conference, turned it online, we did pretty well in terms of the feedback we got, but also the opportunity from everyone who participated. People watched that and said, oh, I need help. I need help. I want to do this. And it was just our luck that we were one of the first big global conferences that didn't get canceled because we stayed the course but moved online. And so since then, my company has pivoted and we're hosting dozens of online conferences, workshops, almost anything that can be done in real life. We try to replicate in as respectful a manner as online. But we've done, for example, a three-day conference for Princeton. We have done a birthday salute to William Shakespeare's 456th birthday. We are hosting the world's largest gathering of teachers this coming Saturday, May 30th. 50,000 teachers, we announced today, will be attending a five-hour conference. It's called the T4 conference. The T stands for teachers and the new normal. And we are very excited about that. And all of this is to say we're very humbled that at a time when people are suffering, there is still interest and need for our services. And we're offering them in as inexpensive and as close to cost as possible where it makes sense. We've given away a lot of things we've done, including working with the Hindu temple in New York to do their first ever memorial for people who died under COVID-19. Just as my friends in Italy will tell you, I mean, this is true in all cultures, but Italians and Indians will tell you nothing worse and nothing an Indian or an Italian fears more than dying alone. And thousands of people have died alone, millions of people. It is so sad that this is the situation we're in.
Yes. And I know that in the last New York Times read-along, you pointed out one of the words that had been coined or mentioned in a New York Times article is weddings. And unfortunately, I don't know if zunerals is a word, but I've been to a couple of those, and it's certainly no comparison to being able to support somebody in real time and hug them. But you're so generous, Sri, with your help and your content. One of the things, again, for our audience of a lot of media folks, you're doing an event with Muckrack that is also a really generous opportunity for journalists. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, thank you. And I will just say what I've learned over the years on the internet is the more you give away, the more you get back. It's almost selfish to be selfless because you get more if you do more for free and you give away more stuff. So that's a kind of weird thing about the internet. And one of the things that happened to me, if you're speaking of stories, is that I lost my job at the Met, this job I loved. And we could talk about that if you like. But I lost my job and it was very public the way I exited from the Met. And I knew how hard it was. I know how hard it is to be for one person to be out of work and what the damage it does to your immediate family and your self-confidence and everything else. And so when you tell me 34 million people are unemployed, 20% unemployment, I am paralyzed by that. So one of the things I tell people is that what can we do? We're not going to be able to create 34 million jobs, but can we help people understand social and digital media better? So my friends at Muckrack, which is a site and a platform to connect PR professionals, public relations, and journalists, they said, we will run a free course and we will host that. And so already 3,000 people have signed up. It starts in June. Anybody who goes to mrack.co/social, mrack.co/social, can sign up for free. It's a two-hour on-demand course with lots of individual components. So it's not like watching a two-hour webinar. It's actually taking quizzes and all of that. And you get a free certification. And we believe that it's something people can show to employers that they have worked. What were you doing all summer? What were you doing during the crisis? Well, here are multiple certifications I got, or here's one I got on social. And so it's free. It's available to the world. And Muckrack is enabling me to be able to pay my adjunct professor, Linda Bernstein, to put that together and compensating me for my time. But I'm using that money in order to pay my team so that we can keep these other shows going. But all of it is to say back to you that this is about being generous is that you get back so much by being generous on the internet.
I think that's a great point. And also, let's dovetail that with you do have to monetize your content in some way. And I don't know how recently it was, but I know that you do have sponsorships available now. And this is not like this free marketing hour. This is, you know, I find it fascinating that you are so generous with your content. You work so hard. You literally talk all the time in a good way, as I said. And I'm glad to see that you do have some level of monetization. How's that going for you?
Well, thank you for noticing. And it's something that's important that I, for example, on my daily show where we didn't have any sponsorship, I didn't ask any of my production team to work on it because I didn't want them to work for free. Like I tell people I'm out of the asking for favors business. Mm-hmm. I'm in the giving favors business, but whenever I can, we need to pay people for work that they do. Professionals should be rewarded for their professional work. So what we've started doing is taking advertising, taking sponsorships, and we learned from the podcasting world that that is something that people can do, but you cannot rely on the automated systems to match you with the perfect ad and all of that. Otherwise, you end up like waiting for the MeUndies team to pick you over everybody else and things like that. So instead, what we've done is created our own ads where we go out and we say to people, we have a great audience, run an ad on our show and you'll be supporting great work. And that's one of the things we've learned that people, if you have an audience, it doesn't have to be a huge audience because I don't have a huge audience, but I have an influential audience. And you combine that with great content and a great audience, advertisers want to step in. And as long as you're not charging thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, people will step up. And in my case, all this work that we're doing also is a showcase for what we can do if you hire us. So we've launched multiple web shows for organizations and individuals and built out their kind of their own, we do this white label show for them that they can use and use for marketing. There's also, as you know, marketing dollars sitting on the sidelines. People are looking for quality shows and products to endorse and spend their marketing dollars. And so we're glad to be able to play a tiny role in that.
It is affordable and it is effective, and you do have so many influential people because of that generosity. I know you have to go, but you mentioned something earlier about being able to do things in a short turnaround. And the last thing I'll say is that you told me that you love Calvin and Hobbes. I want to know why, but I remember that cartoon, the comic strip, and coincidentally, my last interview was with a comic book creator. But I happened to come across this one example that is so apropos to our conversation, which we scheduled like yesterday, and I had 2 seconds to get ready to talk to Sri. But it was Calvin in the sandbox saying to his friend, the tiger Hobbes, you can't just turn on creativity like a faucet. You have to be in the right mood. And Hobbes says to him, what mood is that? And Calvin says, last minute panic. And that's kind of how I felt, but you made this so easy for me. But I do want to know the story behind why you love Calvin and Hobbes so much.
Well, thank you. And imagine saying that you're a fan of this imaginary tiger and this little kid, and you're obsessed with that, which is what I am. And Calvin and Hobbes has played a role in my life for so many years, just as comic books have since I was a little kid. I just love comics and going out there and trying to understand them and what they are and the stories they told. I was very much interested in all of that. And by the way, if your audience hasn't seen Dear Mr. Watterson, the documentary about Calvin and Hobbes, everybody should see it. It is so fantastic. Why I love Calvin is that he is a boy who gets in trouble and who thinks he's taken charge of his own life, but there are greater forces than him that are controlling him. And I've had Calvin and Hobbes on my resume for years, back in the days when you had print resumes, and people would look at that and would ask questions. It would be a way to break the ice. And there would, some people say, I don't know what that is. Or they would say, oh, I love Calvin and Hobbes. What's your favorite cartoon? Those kinds of things have stayed with me as a kind of icebreaker and a way to get people to open up. And sometimes they really don't know. And the shocking thing is that a lot of people think Calvin and Hobbes has been around, you know, as old as Peanuts or one of those shows. It only debuted in 85. So from somebody of my age, that's nothing. I was already 15 when it came out. Uh-huh. So it's not like something I grew up reading. By the time it came to me, wherever I was in the world, I was in Fiji at the time, in high school in Fiji, which is, by the way, as wonderful as it sounds. So that's why I love Calvin and Hobbes. And he is so out of control. And he is also is put in his place by his family, by his friends, by his female nemesis. All of that, I think, is good for him, but he doesn't know it.
So you relate to Calvin more than the sardonic tiger.
Well, I also relate to him, but he is, you know, much deeper than Calvin. And so I'm not that deep.
Well, this was a very deep conversation. Do you have any parting words for us from the mind of Sri Srinivasan about what we should do to stay smart and sharing good content and communicating well?
Well, that's so kind. I don't know if I can do any of those things except to say that no one knows. That, like, that's my mantra at this moment, that no one knows. Not even the sainted Dr. Fauci knows. And there's no playbook for any of the things we're undergoing right now. We're all learning. We're all making it up. And the problem, though, is that some people are making it up without any facts. And some people are making it up with the best facts they have. And I'd much rather go with the latter than the former. You've seen all those FT, the Financial Times has those charts showing how this infection has gone. And the one that I focus on most particularly is the one, there are these two lines. You'll see a South Korea line and you'll see an America line. And the South Korea and America got their first case on the same day. And South Korea is something on the order of a couple of hundred cases of people who have died, and 100,000 Americans have died. And this is a wake-up call to America. And this has shown the best of so many aspects of America, including our first responders, our healthcare workers, the people who do wear the masks and pay attention. But no country in the world has had worse outcomes than us. And what does that tell you? It's because of our leadership. It's because of the misuse of technology, communications, and just an understanding of the world, the role we play in the world as human beings, that I, as an American, have a right to get 50 hand sanitizers. That is the most important thing. Whereas they don't understand that if I get all 50 and the other 49 don't have it, we all die. That's something that we have not understood in this country. I'm hoping some things will change, but the speed at which everybody wants to go back to normal tells me that they will not change the way we hope necessarily. But we all have a role to play in this, and we all have to be as hopeful as we can and pay as much attention. And we have a role to play in this in terms of, you know, if you think even about what happened in 2016, how misinformation, disinformation, and the Russians all combined to change the course of history. It can and very well might happen again because the media hasn't learned, the politicians haven't learned, and consumers and voters haven't learned. And that's my worry.
Well, that was a great final story to tell to keep our through line going, Sri. And I really appreciate that point of view. And I appreciate having a platform that is just one more drop in the bucket for you to get the Sri word out there.
Thank you. If we were on television, I would do a namaste because we can't do handshakes anymore.
Love it. Thank you, Sri. It's so nice to see you and hear you. Well, I hope you got some good inside scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. And I also hope that you'll rate, review, subscribe wherever you download your podcasts. You know the drill. Apple, Stitcher, Google, iHeart. Thanks again for listening.